The horrors that we see today are because of the double standards that have been the practice of the most powerful. We need to move away from that and actually say, whoever you are, if you face harm, as the international community, we will rise up and protect you.
Dr. Pandor, thank you so much for joining me in this conversation. We're so happy to have you, and also for you to deliver the second Dries van Acht lecture. I'm very much looking forward to it. You are, of course, well, the people in the Netherlands know you as the face of the International Court of Justice case, the genocide case against Israel. And I would like to start with the question, why is it for you and for South Africa so logical to have started this case? Can you explain that?
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity. It's really lovely to be here in The Hague and to have the honor of presenting the Dries van Acht lecture. South Africa has long attached to the important values of human rights. Even under the experience of apartheid and in the course of the freedom struggle, the people of South Africa, the oppressed, spent a lot of time thinking about the future and trying to frame a future vision, both of the nature of society they wish to establish after apartheid, but also how they would interface with the rest of the world. In 1955, the people adopted a document that is called the Freedom Charter. In a broad public meeting in an open square in Johannesburg, in a meeting that was called the Congress of the People. And that gathering followed 2 years of public meetings, informal gatherings, where people exchanged ideas about what should a future South Africa look like? What must we attach to? What should be the principles that guide us? And so they framed this Freedom Charter, which had a number of clauses on political, civil, and human rights. One of the clauses was on global cooperation. And they said there must be peace and friendship. And all disputes must be resolved by way of negotiation. This particular clause has been a driving force for the political thinking of post-apartheid South Africa, particularly the African National Congress. And it has framed our foreign policy as one that seeks to encourage nations to unite, to strive for peace, and to seek the best out of humanity. So we believe very strongly that as a country, we must use this belief as our motive for encouraging the rest of the world to really have regard to the interests and human rights of others. Now, the Palestinian people are a people who have experienced oppression and harm for many, many decades. And we identify very much with their struggle because it has many features that are similar to our own experience of apartheid. And so we have had a long solidarity movement in support of the Palestinian people, and this is across the political spectrum in our country. So the most extreme right to the center of left would be very closely linked to the aspirations for freedom of the Palestinian people. And so we have always had links with progressive organizations in Palestine, but have strongly felt that as the global community, we have a responsibility to ensure that they enjoy freedom. Mm. We also believe very strongly in international law and believe that the treaties and conventions of the United Nations draw us together in a common bond in which we've agreed as nations that we will have regard to the interests and protection of those who express oppression. So it's really, I think, that fundamental foundation of a belief in human rights, of an objection to oppression, and of a nation that seeks to ensure that where there is oppression, if possible, we must do something to provide support, and that we use that support in non-armed links, using international law, using instruments available to us as part of the global world community, but also using these instruments to test whether, as the international community, we really are committed to implementing the laws that we frame together at the United Nations. And we felt we couldn't hold back in the face of the terrible onslaught that we were all observing against the people of Gaza. And we thought we had to step in and draw the world's attention rather than being an observer of what we thought was a terrible, terrible conflict.
Thank you. That is, so it is the concept of international solidarity through international law.
Absolutely.
Basically is at the heart of the South African vision on how the world should be. What are your thoughts about the current international order? I mean, we see the international legal order basically being severely undermined from different sides. We have the Russian aggression in Ukraine. We have the American imperialist movements in Venezuela and in Greenland. We have, well, of course, the genocide. There is this undermining or, hollowing out of principles and also, I think, the credibility of the international legal order. What are your thoughts on that? How do we defend that?
I think its credibility has been tested over many, many years.
Yes, much before as well.
I think today we are facing its severest threat because, you know, the breaching of international law that we see today is unparalleled in all the decades since the adoption of the UN Charter. And what is more disturbing is that it is the most powerful nation in the world that is proving to disrespect and actually make a nonsense of all the instruments of international law that exist today, and using the most painful instances of oppression as, you know, the area in which there's an interference, not to reduce harm, but to actually support perpetrators. So unfortunately, those who should be, I believe, the protectors of international law, because it was framed really to protect the vulnerable, in my view, those who should uphold it, who have the power, who have the resources, who have the military might to make a difference for those who suffer oppression, they're actually using it in a most negative way and tearing it to shreds, which poses greater danger for the poorest and most vulnerable. So I'm extremely concerned, and I'm hoping that we can return to reason. We're all looking to Europe to see whether Europe could play a positive role in reasserting the validity and importance of international law. Because in order, I think, to return to a situation in which international law matters and has an impact, you need a powerful countervailing force. So, you know, I often say in South Africa that what you need is the adults need to stand up and really begin to, you know, assert their maturity We're not quite seeing it yet. I think at the World Economic Forum, when the various heads of state were speaking, we got an inkling that there is a possibility.
You mean the Carney speech?
The various speeches, Carney. I thought even the president of the European Union, President Macron, so several leaders began to indicate disquiet at what is happening. But do they have the courage to stand up solidly? This is the test that I think we're all waiting to observe.
Yes. So you come from generations of resistance, right? So you were taught patience because, I mean, that was the only way to move forward. How did you feel supported by the international anti-apartheid movement? And what was for you working as a South African to tear down the structures of apartheid? What was for you the most important supports? And is that something that we can learn also from the struggle for liberation of the South Africans? Also transplanted basically to supporting the Palestinians in their cause.
Yes, I think, you know, there are important lessons from the struggle against apartheid. And certainly international solidarity played a key role because people from all parts of the world lent their solidarity to us. Trade union movements, student organizations, academics. It was very clear to universities all over the world that they could not associate with apartheid South Africa. And the academic boycott was painful for South African academics and universities, but it was important. Trade unions would not carry the goods coming from apartheid South Africa, off ships in Rotterdam or elsewhere. And in fact, one of the strongest international anti-apartheid branches was in this very country, the Netherlands. So I think international solidarity really was critical for us. What is intriguing is why we are not able to marshal a similar solidarity in support of the people of Palestine. I think our moral attitudes in the 80s were far more attached to progressive values than we seem to have today. But there are hopeful signs. The fact that students have stood up is, you know, very significant. They've been protesting. Young people have been very vibrant and vocal, challenging their governments and asking hard questions. But we don't have yet an organized global formation solidly in support of strategies that would directly challenge the oppressive regime that Palestine is confronted by today. With South Africa, I think the distinction was that we were fortunate in having a very old, organized movement, the African National Congress, which had a very strong mass base in South Africa, but which made it its task and business to go out and talk to the international community about our plight and seek their support. And so you had religious organizations, sports organizations, students, academics, everybody in hundreds of countries stood behind our struggle and boycotted, implemented sanctions, business disinvested. All of that put so much pressure that you saw a movement toward the events we had in 1990. And we need a similar global movement to achieve progress for the Palestinian struggle.
Do you think that the Palestinians in Palestine, I mean, they are even physically, of course, torn apart, not only between Gaza and the West Bank, but also by all sorts of administrative barriers and the whole political potential organization is also being oppressed seriously, not only by physical, but also by administrative, security, all sorts of measures. Is that a big difference from, I mean, of course, there was a lot of oppression as well in South Africa, but do you see a difference there as well?
Yeah, certainly. Well, apartheid, hanged many of our leaders.
Yes.
Many of the members of liberation organizations, but they didn't kill 70,000 people. They didn't bomb entire townships. So you have a viciousness today that I think we didn't experience at that level. But also, I think that the size of the population is an issue. We are a majority in South Africa as black people, and therefore we had the numbers that allowed us to organize a mass formation. Effectively, Palestinians don't enjoy those numbers. The level of repression is also very, very strong and in a confined territory. So they do face great difficulty. I also think there's been a real annihilation of their movements, their organizations. I think Fatah and the Palestine Liberation Organization have been decimated. And to some degree, unfortunately, those who are in office may not necessarily be fully behind the cause of freedom. And there are suggestions that there may be co-option, much more than a dedicated commitment to the struggle. You know, Nelson Mandela, while in prison, was offered freedom many years before the 1990. And he said, no, I certainly would not accept conditions which say I cannot be with my people, that I cannot organize, that I must not be political. So there was no sense that our leaders gave up whatever they were confronted by.
There was clarity.
But I do think that with respect to Palestine, the viciousness is extremely harsh.
Yes. We often tend to look at, situations like these as perpetrators and victims. But there's also, of course, the layer of bystanders. And if we take the international law, there's also responsibilities with third parties, states like ours. What would you, as a former Minister of Foreign Affairs, so you were in the business of diplomacy for many years, what would you say to our Dutch leaders, what they should do?
Oh, gosh.
It's a difficult
question. I don't know if I have any advice for them. But I think I'd begin by saying my understanding of international law is that we framed these laws with the anticipation that we would move toward creating societies in which all people are treated equally, in which all perpetrators, should they be guilty, will face the might of the law. We didn't frame international law to suit some and to punish some. But unfortunately, over years, international law has been abused, and it's been seen as an instrument that is used against some dictators in developing countries, but that if you are in the developed world, you are somehow extremely innocent and international law and its institutions can't touch you. We need to return to a world in which we treat everyone, perpetrator, the same way, victim, the same way. Law must not have eyes. law must actually have mercy and justice. And I think our appeal to the most powerful in the world is that we want to hold them to the promises that they've kept making to the world, that democracy is important, that human rights are important, that institutions of good governance are critical, that accountability is a standard we must seek, that transparency is important. These shouldn't be concepts that are used loosely. They must live to address the lives of those who experience the worst forms of abuse. The horrors that we see today are because of the double standards that have been the practice of the most powerful, where if you are dark, you don't really matter. If you are fairer, you're somehow important and deserve protection. Mm-hmm. We need to move away from that and actually say, whoever you are, if you face harm, as the international community, we will rise up and protect you.
Not like the title of Noura Erekat's book, Justice for Some, but Justice for All.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Dr. Bandura.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure having you.
Thank you very much.